Hello and welcome to Two Book Minimum, the podcast where I have yet to come up with a consistent schedule for writing, recording, editing, and uploading any of my episodes. But it's because I'm too busy reading. I'm Monica Fumarello. Welcome to part two of my look at the Shades of Magic series by V.E. Schwab. If you missed my last episode, you might want to go check it out. It's when I talk about my thoughts and, frankly, just unabashed love for books one and two of this trilogy called A Darker Shade of Magic and A Gathering of Shadows. If you don't want to be spoiled, I suggest you read those books, check that out, and then come back to listen to this, where I'm going to talk about book three, A Conjuring of Light. The Essentage has only finished hours ago when Oseron's havoc rains down on Red London, seemingly bringing the end of this magical world and even conquering all of the others as well. Kel is torn between his loyalty to Rai and what he believes he must do as an Antari. Lila, as ever, is caught in the center, torn between her instinct to run and a strange to her desire to stay, to finally wield her power with finesse, or should she continue letting it go full force, raw and brash? And Rai is no longer the carefree, rakish prince he once was, but is wrestling with the nature of his unusual life, his kingdom on the cups of collapse, and stepping into his destiny to become the leader of Arnes that he needs to be to survive. Not necessarily his survival, but the survival of all Londons. No London in any world would be unscathed, with some paying the ultimate price. Okay, I know that is a remarkably short blurb for an incredibly rich and long book, but I'm going to make up for it here right now, I promise. This is your absolute final warning to avoid spoilers. Oh my goodness, this was a reread for me, but wow, I guess I just forgot 98% of this book. I'm almost sure that my first reading of this book was an audio endeavor for me, and the thing that makes me think so is because of the huge gaps in my memory, and I can justify them if it was true that I was also driving to and from work while taking this story in. The only things I remembered from this book are as follows. Rai's parents each having pretty horrible deaths, though I had forgotten the specifics. I remember that Holland died. I remember that the fight against Oseron was ultimately successful. And I remember that Kel is finally allowed to travel. But I thought that only happened at the end of the book, not during the vast majority of it. So let me back up a little bit. At 624 pages, literally about half this book takes place in the 48 to 72 hours after the events of Gathering of Shadows conclusion. Then the second half takes place mostly over the next 4 days. To say that it is a bit of a week for our characters puts it mildly, and then you consider that book two was only a couple of months after book one, and book one took place also only over the course of a couple of days. So anyway, just to think about the fact that this entire series, let's be generous, and takes place over the course of 6 months, that is hundreds and hundreds of pages and years of waiting in between installments. But ultimately, it is so, so worth it. To these characters who have completely captured my attention, let's do a little roundup of what was going on with each of them. Lila, being an Antari, is basically confirmed. I don't know how. I totally forgot this. The part where her glass eye breaks and she replaces it with a new black one, solid like Holland's and Kel's, just chef's kiss. Wow. Her journey is one of my favorites of the whole series, maybe of all serial writing ever. To go from a pickpocket to a pirate to a grand wizard, essentially, and to see all of these changes, but her still remain so completely herself, is admirable, even if what she herself is isn't always shiny and clean. She never claims to be or pretends to be. In no way does she soften because of her relationships and opening herself to these new people. But she becomes more herself, if that makes sense. There is the romantic tension with Kel, the admiration of Alucard. Everything about her is intentional, or if it's not intentional, it is acknowledged and embraced in her own very Lila way. To Rye, oh, our prince, or should I say now our king, I wanted to give him a hug, whereas multiple times in the last book, I simply wanted to slap him upside the head. Getting into his head, along with both Maxim and Elmira's, his parents' points of view, was such a powerful narrative choice. In some ways, Rye's lack of magical ability endears him to me even more as a leader. There's nothing for him to hide behind in terms of his leadership of this city and this country. Without having magic, he learns to step up and lead from smarts and compassion. And even though there are those around him second guessing this, it makes him even more compelling. And in a world where true leadership is harder and harder to come by, it was just such a refreshing thing to revisit. But again, my heart broke for him. Speaking of Rye's parents and their awful, awful demises, I had 100% forgotten about the evil Vesken royal children subplot. I get why it's there. It makes sense. And it certainly gives Princess Cora depth as not just a dumb, love-struck girl, but someone who has agency and, in this case, incredible awfulness. I get it. And it makes for a richer world in that every single character has the potential to be the protagonist of their own story. But I was also kind of meh about it. It felt like it kept taking me away from our central cast and our central plot. It felt more like a side quest. And I guess, you know, that is the definition of a subplot. So, I mean, as someone who formerly once considered herself a writer, I get it. But also as a reader, I was like, can we get back to the good stuff? I don't know. And then Maxim, he blew me away this time. I initially found him to be harsh on his son, but rightly so. And again, those point of view chapters from him and Elmira opened them up in new ways. And I guess it makes sense that I didn't think of them so much before, and that by doing that, it opens them up more now. How many of us really don't acknowledge that our parents are people until we are adults ourselves? And I feel like getting to see that, it was also heartbreaking because you know that Rye's never going to see that. Continuing down our list of characters, Holland, mad, mad props to V.E. Schwab's crafting everything about this character. He is a walking wound. He is a human covered in paper cuts and then holding onto citrus fruit with his bare hands. His past, his smarts, his sacrifice, which is 100% selfish because all he wants is to go home and for that home to be better. Every single thing that drives him and every choice he makes throughout these hundreds and hundreds of pages, there is nothing about him that is for the pure benefit of what is happening in Red London. He could not give a fart. He only cares about White London. He only cares about home. And dear me, these chapters getting into his upbringing and his broken families and his broken hearts, and at the center of it, just longing for a world to be better, and then seeing what that drove him to do, it gives him Challenger deep depths of mystery and feeling. And man, it's one of those things, I don't like him, but I think I respect him. It's wild. He has been a whole roller coaster for me, and by rereading this series, I'm so glad I got to discover it again. Alucard, you, sir, manned up, and I love you for it. Maybe I am most excited to see him and Rye in the spinoff series, which I'm going to be talking about shortly. And all of this brings us to Kel. Sweet baby angel. I had a crush on him. I feel for him. I ache with him. I think he has made a wonderful cornerstone for this entire trilogy. And I think it always bears remembering that he started this whole mess. And he never forgets it. Throughout this entire trilogy, he has that weight on his shoulders. And going from that almost punkish arrogance at the very beginning of book one with, you know, just a guy with a black eye and an unusual coat to he knows what he did and he can't live with himself. And it is driving him and pushing him and maturing him in ways, just the leaps and bounds of it. Adding to the list of things I forgot was how the Antari binding rings, along with the inhibitor to contain Oseron, brought in an extra level to the story. It's a device I'm not sure how I felt about, but I forgot that it left him by the end of the book having physical pain anytime he uses his magic. And that's something that I'm sure is going to be explored. I'm eager to see what it means for his role and his psyche in, again, the coming books. But I completely blocked that out. I also totally forgot that he got to travel during this book. I knew that by the end of it, obviously because his adoptive parents are dead, so the sort of edict that he had to stay in the city is gone. I remembered that Rise wanted that for him and that he took advantage of it. But the fact that he, Lila, and Holland go out and sail and find these gadgets essentially to help share their power and capture Oseron. I totally forgot that happened. And I still, now that I'm reflecting on it, not sure how I think about it. Anytime gadgets come into a fantasy novel, I cannot help but hesitate. It feels a little Deathly Hallows to me in a way. And I challenge if they are too convenient or contrived. Like, you've accidentally unleashed hell. Thank goodness there's an app for that. Maybe I would be more open to it if there had even been a mention of it sooner, or like a background throwaway detail. Again, I don't want to compare things to the series with the boy wizard, but at least there was like a very subtle moment of a Horcrux literally being tossed aside in book 5. And then at the end of book 6, you realize, oh my gosh, that's a thing. And then book 7, it becomes a bigger thing. Here, it just felt like it came out of nowhere. Like Kel had never mentioned anything about Antari artifacts before. And even, I don't remember if Holland did. So anyway, that felt a little middling for me, but I am ultimately willing to overlook it because I still love this series. It remains my favorite part of Schwab's repertoire, and really revisiting it reminded me why I'm so drawn to fantasy stories and fantasy worlds and how they are an avenue of us taking the things that we deal with in reality and both expanding on them and putting them under a microscope. I am also so glad I chose to reread all of these before jumping in to the follow-up series. So if these 3 books weren't enough for you, and they sure as heck weren't enough for me, there is a spin-off series that is currently underway. Book 1 in that series, The Fragile Threads of Power, came out in 2023, and I am just about to start reading it. I didn't want to get into it before I had these books fresh in my head, and because I reread these last year, I'm finally feeling like I can do that with confidence. I had to also just emotionally take a break between finishing book 3 here and jumping into a new book 1. Also, I felt like it was safe to take a little bit of time because book 1, like I said, came out in 2023. Not even an announcement of a title for book 2 yet. So I feel like maybe stretching things out will be
Okay.
It is my understanding with this new series that it is still taking place in the same world. So I'm guessing Red London, but obviously who knows? And that the characters that we got to know in this original trilogy, those who survived anyway, will be characters in this new one, but not necessarily the central characters. They are continuing to play a part, but we are going to have a new cast, new challenges. So some of those loose ends from the original trilogy, like Kel and his powers, Rai and Alucard's relationship, Lila doing whatever the heck Lila does, they're still going to be around, but they're not necessarily going to be the center of the story. But thank goodness they're going to be a part of it. Overall, this series is just continues to blow my mind and getting me back into a mood for fantasy. As I look here in my notes for the plans I have for this podcast, many, many series of fantasy books from my past and series maybe that I didn't finish, or I finished one and then more spinoffs came. I'm just really excited about this again. And maybe there is something to be said for the volume of books I read and the fact that my memory can't hold on to them or that things blur together, because then upon rereading, I get to feel like I'm falling in love with them all over again. So how lucky am I in that way? Anyway, I sincerely hope that you will continue to hang on along with me on this ride. Again, cannot say enough great things about V.E. Schwab's series, The Shades of Magic. They are available wherever bookstores are sold, or you want to help out your public libraries lately, they sure could use the support. If you liked what you heard here today, please like, please subscribe, please download, tell your friends. I am seeing that I've gotten downloads apparently from Canada, Sweden, Germany, Norway, and the Netherlands. Super cool, as well as 88.8% of my listeners being from the United States of America. Let us continue to read what we want, when we want, where we want. Censorship can go down to Oceron, burning pit of Black London hell, as far as I'm concerned. And may your to-read list never get shorter, and may your story options always be abundant. And until next time, happy reading.